Accession number 3998, Reel 4.
Major Hassock, tape number 4. You were telling me about the troops' party.
Yes, well, the party used to be called an azuma, the Arabic word for it. Now, this is a sort of a drinking party where the soldiers and the women appear, which is the only time I ever went to any party where the women were, as at these official military azumas. And I'd been to one or two with the headquarters in El Obeid, but the first one I went to with the Camel Corps out in the wilds, where I was in Bara, was quite an eye-opener and quite an experience. The party itself, they have a drink which they make, a local brew, which they're permitted to have under their own law and under the government law, named Marisa, which is a form of, to me, I just tasted it once, and it was like a sour porridge. And it's a whitish, porridgey-looking appearance that I would imagine it was a taste you would have to become addicted to enjoy. But I just had a sip of it, and it nearly turned me up. But that was the one drink that they were allowed legally to drink anyhow. And they used to have these occasional parties, and once or twice a year they had the big one when the British company officers were invited. And they're always at night, and usually after the British dinner time, or usually about 9 o'clock at night, and they were held on the Maidan adjacent to the soldiers' quarters. And the women came with the soldiers, and it was a torchlight affair, with torches and Petromax lamps held by the soldiers to afford the lighting. And first of all, it comprised of singing and dancing, just the usual Muslim singing and stamping of feet, and the women in the background, behind the men, all chanting and screaming the queer Arabic way that they do. Then, after a certain stage, the dancing stopped. And this is done in a circular formation. And they form, the troops are all in plain clothes, not in uniform. And then a man, one of the soldiers, comes out with a camel whip. And bear in mind, these are all ex-camel troops. A lot of them still have their own camels. And there still are camels in the company, as a matter of fact. And for a short time, I had one myself. And we still had camels and, of course, the camel whips. Anyway, this particular night at the Azuma, out in the middle of the dancing square, comes steps one of the chaps who we knew to be a sergeant in his plain clothes with the camel whip, which he started cracking about. And then, to our surprise, out comes a soldier who we knew was one of the young soldiers of the company, who dances around the man with the whip, and then he stands in the centre of the square, takes off his shirt, exposing his bare back, and stands with his arms gripping in the front of him, gripping his hands tightly in front of him, legs apart, shoulders hunched. And after lots of shouting and caterwauling from the women and applause from the men, the chap with the whip starts to lash the man with the camel whip across the bare naked shoulders. And of course each one lacerates about 9 inches, 10 inches across the whole of the back, across the shoulders. And the man has to, he takes 6 of these, and he has to do this without flinching. And this is his form in the camel corps. This is the form of, they are men. They have approached then in the eyes of the comrades, they are men. And I didn't know until this particular night that every one of my soldiers had got all these lashes on his back. Because when they leave the area, the women take them away, and I'm told, I was told then, and I've no reason to disbelieve it, that they rub salt into the wound to help it heal and leave scars. So, because the scars are the things that prove that they've undergone this form of initiation. And I saw 2 men in the years I was in the Camel Corps dealt with like that, these Germans. I think it was 2, may have been 3, but it was quite something. And to see these fellows accept this punishment for nothing, they hadn't done anything, purely initiation. It was quite amazing. And now I hope we're all right, are we?
Where did the troops live?
The troops lived in grass tuckles or small houses in a compound, which was the quarters, what I refer to as the quarters. It was the, I can't now remember the Arabic name for the, it was the lines, in other words. It was what you might call the lines. And the single troops lived there as well as the married troops. The single troops all had the women anyway. The ones who weren't married, they all had women, either as servants or chattels, you know.
Were many of the troops married?
Well, here again, this was something I didn't know. But I think most of them were, because, as I say, they all had women. Whether they were married to them or not, I don't know. It was just the way of life, you know. But they all lived in this area of about, I suppose it must have been about 1/4 mile square.
Who did
full of, and only the, that was all the Camel Corps, Sudan Defence. Nothing to do with the village of Bara. Now, the village of Bara itself was an area, we were north of El Obeid, and I suppose you could say it was a northern Kordofan area headquarters, although only 40 miles from El Obeid, and the northern part of the province extending from under a couple of 100 miles north to Dongola province. It was fairly near, it wasn't really very north, but it was a northern area, and we had a district commissioner there. And the name Bara means something to do with the well and water and garden, because it was quite a nice little place. It had very deep artesian wells, and it was really an oasis, and quite a good population, I suppose, about 2,000 people there, about 2,000 strong. As I say, it had its own Merkus, that is town hall, administrative building, with its own district, British district commissioner, then a native Madea, who was the equivalent of the head native official. And it was quite a nice village. We were about, I suppose we were about, again, 1/4 mile from the village, up a bit of a rise in the terrain, across a Maidan, and we were segregated, quite segregated, as were we, the British officers' compound, from the native officers' area, which was the, again, about 1/4 mile from where our compound was, and our compound was about 1/4 mile across a Maidan from where the soldiers' area was. And we never went into the soldiers' area. We never went to the, that was their private area. That was always maintained by the native officers. The British staff never, the British officers never went over there.
What were your relations like with the native officers?
Oh, very good. As I say, you used to have them. You'd entertain them once in a year, and they'd entertain you once in a year. But on the duty side, there was one native officer in charge of the transport, who was a sort of transport officer, although you must remember this was in the early days of mechanisation, and they were a little bit inexperienced, to put it briefly, you know, and politely. But we did, on one occasion, of course, this was in the old days, as you might say, of the Sudan Defence Force transforming into the new Sudan Defence Force, when we started getting cadets, cadet trained and from Gordon College, educated top officers from Gordon College, second lieutenants. Now, we had one of these. Now, a second lieutenant was a Malazim Tani. The first lieutenant was a Malazim Owl, and now we had one who was the son of the, let me get this right, when Gordon was assassinated, he was assassinated by, my memory slips.
The Mahdi?
The Khalifa. No, the Mahdi, that's right, the Mahdi. And after everything was simmered down, the Mahdi's relatives went and lived on an island near Kosti on the River Nile. Well, there were two religious factors. One was... I'm afraid my memory's given way here. There were two. One was Sir Syed Ali Magani. They were both knighted, these fellows. And the other was Sir Abdul Rahman Al Mahdi. I think that was his name. Now, the one was something to do with the Khalifa, I think. And one was something to do with the Mahdi, you know, a descendant. And, wait a minute, Sir Abdul Ali Magani. Sir Abdul Ali Magani, funnily enough, had a house in Khartoum, not far from where eventually I lived when I was married in the war years. I had a house. But Abdul Rahman Al Mahdi, Sir Abdul Rahman Al Mahdi, had a house in Khartoum likewise, but also he lived on an island in near Kosti in the River Nile, which was about 200 miles south of Khartoum. And his son, this chap, was a descendant of the Mahdi. I don't know whether it was his son or his grandson, I forget now. But this young second lieutenant, educated at Gordon College, which later became Gordon University, Khartoum University, came to us on his first posting. Now, he spoke English, as well as Arabic. Now, he was sent up to me to learn about vehicles and the MT side of life, you see. And he'd done his cadetship in the cadet school in Omdurman. As I say, educated originally at Gordon College and then gone to cadet school and then come out to the Camel Corps. And he'd been at headquarters in El Abeid for about a month, then posted out to us for a trial period. Well, this was the one and only time I met an officer of any rank, or even a Sudani, if you like, of any rank, that I didn't like. He was, over the years, as I'm telling you now, although I haven't discussed it, we did come in contact with lots of Arabs of all classes, and of all statures too, from senior Arab, senior native officials down to ordinary local lamas and sheikhs and things like that. And so one got to know pretty well how to cope and deal with them and treat them, and you learnt how to cope with the various courtesies and customs of the Muslim way of life by your own experience living with among them, you see, and working with them from day to day. But this one particular chap, he was the only one that I won't say I didn't get on with him, I just, he didn't like me and I didn't like him. I don't know how he got on with the other officers. We never discussed him because he didn't stay with us long, and we sent him back. I think the trouble was he was the only educated native officer. When I say educated, I mean classically educated. And he spoke very good English. He came from a very wealthy family. He was one of what I termed the new Sudan Defence Force types, or if you like, the new Arab, the new Sudani, who were beginning to come to the fore. Because until the later years, you didn't get a very intensely educated Sudani. Although he'd been to Gordon College, he still maintained the old tribal ways and customs, you know. But this chap, with his background, his education, and he was a clever lad, he was the first one that I met, that a native officer that I didn't like. And it was quite fantastic. It was just like some of these young fellows you meet now. You couldn't tell him anything. And he would argue. And there's nothing worse than in front of natives, something you just didn't do. You didn't argue in, not in Arabic. And he was too good for me to argue with in Arabic. I couldn't cope with his Arabic. And, I mean, my Arabic was mainly colloquial, you know, I didn't learn classical Arabic. And he spoke to me in English, and he would argue in English in front of the troops when I was showing him something or explaining something. And he would, and I think he was trying to make out to the native what a clever lad he was, you know. The native. I don't know whether this was right, but as I say, I couldn't. His Arabic was classical, and I couldn't understand a lot of it when I heard him speaking to the troops. You see, this is right. Although when I was learning Arabic, I went to Palestine to learn a little Palestinian Arabic. I still hadn't. I always found it easier to talk to the lesser educated Arab than the educated Arab, because I suppose that was the way I learnt my Arabic. I mean, I didn't mix with the highfalutin Arab when I was learning Arabic. I mixed with the ordinary man in the street sort of thing. And my teachers were ordinary teachers from the small schools. I didn't go to Gordon College or anything like that. And consequently, this young chap was the only one of all the native people I came across that I really didn't get on with. I never knew what happened to him, because he left. I never met up with him again. I never met up with him again because he left our company. He was sent back to Khartoum, I think, or El Obeid. But during the war years, when I stayed with the SDF until 1944, I never heard of him. I don't know what happened to him. But certainly, I was with the Ghazal Force, as I told you, during the early part of the, well, all through the East African campaign, the Eritrean campaign, and right into it finishing in Abyssinia. And I never came across this chap. And so I don't know what happened to him, whether he went on the staff or what, I wouldn't know.
Were there many more examples of these new sorts of officers?
He's the only one I met in the Camel Corps. I met another one in Khartoum in a Stores and Ordnance branch, who was I think he was doing administration. He was quite a nice chap. And I bumped into one or two in headquarters in Khartoum who were all right, you know. And I met one on active service with another unit, and he came to see me for some technical help once, and he was quite all right too. I never experienced any trouble with anybody else. Just this one particular chap. I remember him as if it was yesterday.
Was this part of a conscious policy of giving the Africans more responsibility in the Sudan?
No, I think ultimately, yes. But that was the educational side, you see, because, as I say, Gordon College has now became Khartoum University after the war. But the big change in the Sudan came when the war was on, which is really out of the scope of this talk, isn't it? Because when, you see, the Sudanese was a simple soul, and he'd lived this way of life in the Sudan Defence Force and in the civilian side too, for years and years and years. Well, then the war came, and we were augmented by the Indian Army. We had the 5th Indian Brigade came to us, the 4th or 5th Indian Division. I forget which was the 4th or the 5th. And they were, actually, we were intermingled with them on the Eritrean frontier. And as I explained, our way of life was rather lavish when we were trekking, and it was the same in the war years. We had a rather super tents with a bath extension at the end. You had your own boy that looked after you, you had your cook with you. And life, except for being under canvas, your life was quite all right. You mingled, that was one of the times when you all three, the British officers and the British NZ, all mucked in together. Although your tents were quite a long way apart for privacy, you usually met either for drinks or perhaps once every other night and had a meal together, and for company. But you didn't rub it in too much, you know, you didn't rub it in. You kept your own privacy as well. And I used to have, when in the war years I'm talking about now, not before the war, but I had a wireless, which was a luxury, run off car batteries, you see. And it was the only one. I was the only one who had one with Gazelle Force. And I was out in the blue at a place away from our advanced headquarters, and on my own with the workshops, all camouflaged and right in the front line. And an Indian Army unit came in this same oasis camping next to me, and their officers, the British officers, came over. And don't forget, this was the war, I was still a sergeant with my rank. So when the war started, we had to show our rank, you see. And we, although we were promised commissions, we never got them because they couldn't replace us with Arabic-speaking NCOs, you see. So we were done down a little bit. There were only three of us. There were only three or four British NCOs out of the whole Sudan Defence Force allowed to return to the British Army and accept commissions. None of us were commissioned at the outbreak of war like we would have been in the British Army. So anyhow, I was there doing this job that in any other force, at least a captain would have been doing it, you know, with a good staff. And I had a mobile workshop at the time I'm telling you about. And the Indian Army officers used to come over to me, and they were quite flabbergasted at the luxury that I was attending this war in, you see, with my two servants and my double-ply tent with bathroom, bath every night and all this, you see. And, I mean, when you live out there and speak the lingo and know the ropes, there's no trouble. You're camping near wells, there's no trouble your boy going and filling your big, what they call a zamzamir, that's a big zinc 5-gallon or 10-gallon container of water from the well. You see, the Arab, they get in with the Arabs who are looking after the wells, you boys do, and they get the water off them. So every night you have a bath, you see. And of course, the Indian troops didn't know this, didn't know the ropes, you see, and the Indian army officers thought that, oh, my way of life was terrific. But they had servants too. And their servant allowance was a lot higher than ours. Their standard of pay and everything was far higher than what the Saddam was in the Indian army. The troops got more money. The native troops. Their officers, and they'd not be NCOs, but their officers got more money. They had, I never met any BNCOs in the Indian army in the field. I met a British warrant officer in Khartoum in the Indian army. And as a matter of fact, I took a big vehicle park over from him. I've been promoted myself then. And however, this is all wartime and really isn't in this part of the talk. You want to know about it before the war. Well,
how did you cope with the loneliness? You were saying that you were only one of three British NCOs.
Well, I used to be very interested in. I taught myself quite a lot of things. I once saw, we'd had a theft in my workshops, and I once saw a man pick out the guilty person by who he was the expert tracker of the area, and he was on loan from the police to come and he was attached to the police. This man, he was an elderly man, and he said he knew he would find out who'd stolen it. Was it stolen some wood from my carpentry store. And the next day we found this, and so we reported it, and reported to the DC, who got the local police up, and they got this tracker came along. And we'd been told to keep the area clear, you see, because from the garage area and the workshop area was concrete, but then from the concrete was pure sand, you see, so whoever had carried and taken this wood away had gone in, would have to go in the sand. So we kept all the troops away, and the only footprints there being people, either the British officers or one or two soldiers who'd been there, and the thieves. So the local police sent up this tracker, and he smoothed out, quite fantastic, about 3 yards square of sand near my workshops, just adjacent, and I was watching, most interesting. And then every soldier in the company had to walk across this small area of sand, go right across, and then come back again. And then the tracker would wipe the footprints clear. And occasionally he'd tell one soldier to go and stand over there. And we had two or three civilian police had come up too with his tracker, and so the chap had to go and stand near the police. Well, after about 120, all the soldiers available on duty had gone through. He'd got about four that he'd put over there, you see. So then he'd cleared this all up. And this took quite a time because he had to keep sweeping it over, you see, and smoothing it over. And then he got these four. And he dwindled it down to two. And then he went, the two of them, one, he made one walk